If you travel, you know how to really go off the grid. Like no cell service in your room off the grid. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, sound baths, and ice baths? Because when you set up your out of office, you mean it. Because when you're the escape artist, vacation is all about resting, meditating, drinking water, and minding your own businessing. The Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Learn more at go.amex/you know.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi, I'm Eric.
I'm Brittany.
And we are...
We're color nerds.
The conversations that black people have.
When white people are not in the room.
But we record them.
And we put them on the internet.
How's it going?
Man, I'm doing good.
I'm excited for today.
Sorry, I'm excited for today, too. I got a new bra yesterday.
Congrats.
Thank you. I got my nails.
You've been talking about it for a while.
I've really needed one for a while. I got my nails done and my eyebrows done. I feel like a brand new woman. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Last night, I had Wingstop. I hadn't had Wingstop since John was here, my friend John.
Oh my God, John moved away a year ago.
No, he came, he moved away a year ago. He came back around the birth of Peanut. And we got Wingstop, and that's when we bought all the LeBron's mixed Sprite.
Oh my God.
And we literally bought like 6 2-liters of LeBron's mixed Sprite, proceeded to drink it all, and ate Wingstop. It was a wonderful
day.
Wait,
you drank all the 2 liters?
Not in one day.
Oh, my God.
But
I thought it was like one sitting.
Over the course of like a week.
Oh, okay. You know, still at least a syrupy blood, but
it's not,
okay.
Not too bad. I'm still here. Still
yeah,
kicking.
I guess so. Oh, by the way, shout out, John. Congratulations on your engagement.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
She didn't say no.
She didn't say no. Although, no, actually, I told him. I was like, I never doubt it.
I texted him the morning of, and I said, you know what, John? No matter what happens.
You shot your shot.
I was like, regardless of what happens, I still support you.
But no, they are going to be an awesome couple. Shout out to John.
Yeah.
That's my homie and my brother. But yes. Other than that, that's it. I had Wingstop. It was great. I'm living life to the fullest. I'm still black.
Oh, really? That's interesting. When you mentioned Wingstop earlier, you made it sound like you were having some issues.
Well, I mean,
issues.
There's opportunity cost to everything, you know?
But
I enjoyed it when I had it.
Well, I guess we should get it cracking.
Yes.
We have
yes.
somebody else with us.
Oh, man. So happy. Do you want to? You should introduce.
Yeah. So I'm sitting with us in the studio today, prolific writer at MTV News and co-host of the podcast Speed Dial with Ira Madison III. Doreen St. Felix.
Yes.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Welcome.
Yay. This is so exciting. We've talked about what you write so
oh
many
times. Oh, my God.
At least
four or five times.
Yeah, four or five times.
Literally.
Easy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That means the world to me on this lovely Saturday morning.
Yes. Morning.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's early.
It is. Right now, it's not that early, but it is still morning.
It was. It was early. This time.
Well, I mean, you know, the point is that we're all sitting inside of an office on a Saturday, which, you know, we all sacrifice time to be here. So
this is called commitment.
We thank you.
Yes.
We thank you.
I'm so excited to be here.
So, yeah, so you write.
I do.
And like a topic that we love when you write about is black women, regardless of what they do. Favorites for us, black teens on Instagram and Vine, breaking the internet and not getting the profits. The one that you wrote about. Kayla Newman, a.k.a. Peaches Monroe, a.k.a. Eyebrows on Fleek.
Yes.
The fuck?
Indeed. Last month was the 2-year anniversary of the genesis of On Fleek.
Has it been 2 years?
It's been crazy 2 years.
Wow.
I had a coworker who recently found out what On Fleek was. And it was amazing because, like, I think that she thought that nobody else knew either. And everybody, literally everybody else, regardless of age, race, whatever, in the office was like, no, I know what On Fleek is. They're like, no.
They weren't going to get caught slipping.
Yeah, like, they were old like, girl. Nah. But also, like, a love profane, beautiful piece you wrote about Lemonade, Prosperity Gospel of Rihanna.
It's definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, Eric put me onto that one.
Yeah. No, I'm a big Rihanna fan, and I also appreciate just how she, like, how she lives her life to the fullest at all times. Yeah. But yeah, and I think a lot of people often, like, give her shit because of the way she, like, flaunts what she's acquired. And I thought it was a really, really great breakdown on how, like, I mean, you need to back the fuck off. She's Rihanna because she's lit. but yeah, no, it was great. It was great. And we'll include all of these in the show notes.
You will definitely include all these in the show notes. But, like, you write about Black women who are famous and not necessarily different ages, different socioeconomic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Like, aside from the obvious, like, what's the draw?
You know, it goes back to 4 years ago when I was an undergrad. I was studying English and there was a track within my school and it was called nonfiction. And it essentially was like new journalism. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to just like going out and straight reporting, it was like, okay, like write criticism about whatever subject in pop culture or science, whatever thing that you're thinking about. And of course, I was doing a lot of like Africana studies at that point. And so I was drawn to the idea of Blackness in women in unconventional spaces and those spaces that academia doesn't really address.
Yeah.
So stuff like music, fashion, the internet. And I got a whole lot of shit from all of my advisors, all of my teachers, basically because it was like this thing where if I was in the writing department, they were like, oh, you're writing about Blackness. That's academic. But then if I was in the Africana department, it was like, oh, we don't talk about, like, you're not writing about the struggle necessarily. So that doesn't constitute what we would do in this department. So I was just the black sheep within both of those programs. And it really, like, put me off from writing. I didn't write for a very long time. And then I started tweeting. This is probably like 2 years ago. I was tweeting and I found this like incredible community of women online who were thinking the way that I did. And now it sounds silly to me to be like, I didn't realize that it was sanctioned to write criticism about Black women in pop culture in that way.
Yeah.
You know, to use like deconstructionist methods to talk about Rihanna or to talk about Beyonce. I just didn't know it was possible. I didn't know you could do it. Mm-hmm. And then once I found out you could do it, I was like, bitch! So the first piece that I wrote was the Rihanna piece. Yeah. I did that for Pitchfork about a year and a half ago at that point. And I think since then, it's just been forward momentum. And I've been, you know, trying to integrate reporting as much as possible into this criticism because I think it's really easy for people to dismiss writing like that. It's part of the whole backlash against poptimism, which I don't know if people know what it is, but it's essentially just like it started in music criticism, but they kind of feel like the only music that should be taken seriously is rock and roll music that's created by white men. And so there's been a renaissance of young critics of all different races and genders who are like, no, actually, that's not right. So I think for me, it's been like, okay, how can I evidence that that's true? I can do that by talking to people. I can do that by looking at numbers. So that's, I think, where I am right now in my process of growing as a writer.
Wait, so the Rihanna piece was the first thing that you ever wrote professionally?
Yes.
Wow.
Girl, what?
Came out the gate. Swinging.
Wait, it was indeed.
If you could just like briefly explain from the horse's mouth, like what that piece is about.
Absolutely. So in March of 2015, a one Rihanna put out a single called Bitch Better Have My Money. And, you know, the ripple effects were huge. People were just like so into the message of it. But I felt that it was also simultaneously not being like considered in, you know, a serious way.
There was definitely a lot of backlash.
Yeah.
Like before, I'm sorry, I'll let you continue with the summary, but definitely like before the video came out, folks were like, what is this about?
Yeah, because I think people, and Beyonce gets that response a lot too, where people are like, you're rich. Who do you need money from? Like, you have more money than I do. Mm-hmm. But in my piece, I try to argue within the larger structure of music and you can make this argument about sports too, the performers, people like Rihanna, mm-hmm. the players, people like give any black yeah. sportsmen, are not making anywhere close to the amount of money that they should be making mm-hmm. from the money that they generate. Therefore, when a subject like that puts out a message that's like, actually, I'm going to liberate myself through capitalism mm-hmm. and I'm going to make myself bigger and stronger with all of the material that I accrue, with all of the women I put next to me, that is a message that isn't, I just think it's radical. And I know it's like, I got a lot of backlash towards my essay as well from people being like, well, if somebody is within that capitalist structure, it's, you know, it's problematic to say that they are radical. But I
but
think
who's outside of the structure? Exactly. What I'm wondering.
I just think that's I don't think that that argument really means anything material. It's not yeah. something that you can actually you can't have a rebuttal to it because we're all obviously we created the structure.
Yeah. yeah.
Slavery. Remember it? So I tried to investigate the ways. There's a visual culture around black women and carrying cash, like physically. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this is not the first time that Rihanna has associated herself with money in that kind of vulgar way. So in the Pour It Up video, you know, she has the,
yes.
the dollar bills with her face on it. Yes. And it's like a couple of months ago when we found out that Harriet Tubman was going to be mm-hmm. on the $20 bill. That was the first image I thought of. Oh, damn, like Rihanna put herself on currency too.
Had to sow the seeds, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what the piece was just about. Black girls getting money is a beautiful thing.
The first thing that I ever wrote that I published wasn't at Pitchfork, right? What made you be like, okay, this is something that like I need to like actually publish. I need to put it out there. It needs to be put out at that level.
That's a great question. Well, one of the reasons is purely logistical. I had this wonderful editor, Jessica Hopper, who's actually now my editor at MTV News.
Oh my God, she did a she knows a lot about the whole R. Kelly situation.
Yeah, she was basically the journalist that broke that story.
Oh my gosh,
she wrote like a. It wasn't a book, was it? She wrote a book about it? Or
maybe she wrote a book about it.
Series of essays or something like that.
She had a series of essays come out last year. I don't remember the title exactly, but the gist is she's the only living female rock critic. And so it's a bunch of essays of the criticism that she's done. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she had contacted me months before and was just like, hey, listen, like, you should be publishing mm-hmm. based on your tweets. Like, you should be doing it. And I was like, well, I'm actually a little bit scared and I don't want to. So when I was watching the conversations happen around Rihanna, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. In general, I had been kind of confused why there wasn't serious music criticism on Rihanna. I mean, you can look at the New York Times, the New Yorker. There aren't the essays that are applied to women artists who are also part of her class.
Yeah.
So like Sky Fiera gets, you know, broken down and considered intellectually, but not Rihanna.
Yeah.
And that obviously has everything to do with her race.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to set out to be the person who was going to be like, you know what? She's a pop star and pop is a serious machine. And mm-hmm. so we're going to take her seriously. So I think that was like my major motivation.
What was like the transition like, you know, to go from like, I'm just tweeting, like nobody knows what I'm talking about, to mm-hmm. like everybody's reading and talking about this thing. What was that like emotionally?
It was really intense and I really resisted it because, I mean, to have your first piece blow up in that way makes you scared to publish a second piece because
sophomore slump.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if it's not as good, what do you do when you're hoping to find the same reaction? But obviously, it's just not possible that people are going to react to everything that you write in that way because not every subject that you're engaging with is at the top of, you know, the cultural forefront. So I kind of like sat back and I was like, okay, I'm going to become a freelancer. In order mm-hmm. to become a freelancer, I need to make connections. I need to make schedules. And so I really preoccupied myself with just like organizing. And then after that, things came kind of swiftly. Like I think I wrote that Toni Morrison piece about Sula, the Reader's mm-hmm. Guide. I think mm-hmm. that came out like 2 weeks after. So I just kind of like had tunnel vision and was like, okay, my project is going to be to take black women seriously. So I have to go to those outlets that are going to allow me to do that.
I mean, one of the things I think you do really well is in terms of making those like connections, making those cultural connections to other things. Where are you going for those things? Like, obviously, we consume a lot of media, but mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that can be challenging is like actually saying like this really relates to this, and like creating some sort of process for making sure that you can identify it. Because like Brittany said, you're pretty prolific. You write, like you write very consistently. And it can be challenging. Like, I mean, we talk about, like, struggling to find ideas.
Oh, my God.
I could talk about that, too.
Yeah. But I mean, you seem to have created, like, a healthy process for making those connections through mm-hmm. your criticism. Could you talk more about that?
Thank you so much. I think for me, it's about being really honest with myself about what is, you know, maybe a mirage and what is actually a phenomenon. So that is to say, when you are a Black freelancer, I'm not a freelancer anymore, but when I was, of course, I was getting contacted by editors to write, you know, one-off think pieces. Mm. Like, this thing happened at 9 a.m., write me something by 3. And more often than not, I would say no, because I didn't think that that was enough time for me to, A, tell the story in a way that's actually compelling, but also, B, I'm not going to be, like, your Black reactionary platform, because you don't have anybody on staff. You just need me to like give a statement on the state of Blackness. So I think that was one thing that was really important for me to do, was to resist those like quick bursts of energy, because at the end, like in the long run, they really exhaust you. And then you can't see the larger stories, the larger connections that are happening. And so I think just taking your time and making sure that you do research, that you read a little bit further. Guaranteed, if you're seeing one thing happen, there's like 10 stories behind it. And I think when I was writing the Fader story about Black teens not getting paid for, you know, the cultural material they create, initially I was just like, oh, you know, this is something that's just happening in the late aughts to now. Like, this is a product of the internet. And then when I was talking to more people, it was like, oh, no, actually, this has to do with intellectual property law. And so I think just taking my time. It's funny that you say I'm consistent, because sometimes I feel like I'm a little bit slow. But I just don't want to ruin my approach as a journalist to, like, make some deadlines that at the end of the day don't really matter.
Yeah. Damn.
There was, no, I mean, but that's real though. Like, you do feel like a lot of pressure. You were on your honeymoon, and I don't know what I don't know where I was. I might have just been at work or tired or something like that. But we couldn't do a Lemonade episode for a while, and it, like in the back of my mind, I kept thinking like,
shit, everybody's gonna put it out.
Yeah, everyone's gonna be done. But like, there was stuff that we were able to talk about in conversation that we were able to have that was still different than what a lot of other people did, and like waiting like a couple weeks didn't ruin anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The news cycle as it is right now, it's just so, so fast. Mm-hmm. So it's like, there is that like pressure, like, we got to turn out of this episode. Mm-hmm. We got to turn out of that episode. But I mean, the truth is, you, like, you're right. Once you sit on that information and really decide like how you actually feel about it, like a lot of things will present themselves as far as what your take should be.
Yeah. And I think people probably look to your episode differently than the way that they might have looked to an episode that came out that week, which is why podcasting can actually kind of like subvert the news cycle in a really interesting way.
Oh, shit. Say more about that. Yeah. Say, because I struggle with this. Say more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we look to, or I look to, I've traditionally looked to radio, and then obviously podcasting is the son of radio, for a different approach. Like, if I want to get like that quick information, writing is much better for that, because there's less organization to do. Like, it's just like one person most likely. But I think with podcasting, what you want to do is you want to hear the various theses that a person might have. You want to hear them process it, and you want to hear them get to those conclusions. Mm-hmm. And I think Lemonade in particular, because it was such a rich text, I waited 5 days to write a piece, and I was like, ah, fuck, am I waiting too long? So, and then after I published it, I was like, oh, no, like, I could have written so much more. And so I think, because podcasting obviously is not going to happen on that day-to-day clip, y'all are at an advantage to be like, okay, we already don't even work in your, like, quick factory-like production.
Yeah.
So we'll take our time to give you just what ends up being, in my opinion, a different product, doing different work.
Yeah, I mean, we agree.
So much better about my job.
That's what I'm here for.
Maybe this has value.
I have one question before we move on to the next portion of the conversation, yeah. which I know Eric is chomping at the bit.
Can't sit still.
Your pinned tweet on your profile. I love it. It's so good. Everybody want to be a black woman, but nobody want to be a black woman. What is that about?
I mean, it's about the state of America. Listen, so obviously the original iteration of that quote is from Paul Mooney. Mm-hmm. Paul Mooney is a great black comedian. Mm-hmm. Kind of unsung, I would say, right?
Yeah.
And you can like watch the Chappelle clip and he's like, everybody want to be a nigga, but nobody want to be a nigga.
Yeah.
Which is true.
Yeah.
And some people would argue that nigga is a gender-neutral term. But obviously, when people hear that word, and the sentiment that he was getting across was that everybody wants to be a black parentheses man, but nobody wants to be a black parentheses man.
Yeah.
And so it was important for me to... It's kind of like... I could describe it as like a little totem I have. Because like my Twitter timeline is my home on the internet. Mm-hmm. When I'm working online, like I always go back to it. And so when I have that there, it's like, oh, yeah, this is like what your job is as a critic. You're supposed to look at the ways that the labor black women have performed throughout American and also global history have been kind of like sublimated through other people. And so the Kardashians is a really good example of that. And Sylvia Obel at BuzzFeed wrote that just tome
amazing.
Of a piece. Tome of a piece on the history of China and the Kardashians. And she has this really great bit where she, like, very methodically goes through the ways the Kardashians have made a product of what are considered attributes and behaviors of black women.
Yeah.
And when you see that so, it's just done so clearly, it's like, oh, shit, like, there actually is a very clear way to trace how black women have become commodities. Not like in an academic way. It's just like, no, here are these behaviors. Here's China. Here's Amber Rose. Mm-hmm. Here is how the Kardashians like took that up. And here's their empire. Like, it's just three steps. Like, you don't need to do like a lot of complicated like calculus to understand that. And so for me, it's just a reminder of like behind any cultural phenomenon, there's black women's labor that's getting ignored.
So that is a great
uh-oh.
I think that's a great point one. And that's also a good spot to transition to the next subject of conversation.
Lord, so, you gotta help me.
Well, no, I mean, I think you'd be surprised. So you mentioned, we reached out to you. We were like, what don't you get a chance to talk about? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what can we talk about that doesn't come up often? And you said one thing that definitely piqued, like, both of our
immediately
interests. Oh, no. You said that you get a sordid comfort from watching Tyler Perry movies and shows. So,
guilty as charged.
So Tyler Perry is a little, you know, he's someone who people have complicated feelings about.
Yes.
I say black folks have complicated feelings about.
Yeah.
So, I mean, say more about that comfort that you get from watching Tyler Perry.
All right. I'm going to take you guys back to, let's say, the year 2000. I have an older sister. My sister is 10 years older than me. Mm-hmm. At that point, Tyler Perry was gaining a lot of local fame through his plays.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We grew up in New York, but my sister, she had a lot of Southern friends who, you know, they would get basically like DVDs of his plays.
Yeah.
And you could get them and then after a while, you could get them at the beauty shop.
Yep.
Like everywhere.
People on the street.
Yeah.
People on the street. They were selling them like Nigerian movies, basically.
Yeah.
Shout out Nollywood. So, of course, I started, you know, watching them with my sister and my mother. And initially, I didn't really get a lot of the like cultural references because, I grew up Catholic in the Northeast, which is very different from growing up like, you know, general Christian down south, and also like I was a little bit younger. But watching my mom like so viscerally connect to this like facile content made me just think like, I ended up creating this connection in my head where it was like, oh, like when you're grown, you get Tyler Perry. And so in the interest of wanting to be grown, I started to watch his stuff nonstop. Like I watched so many of the plays on DVDs and then he started doing the movies. So I was like, all right, Family Reunion, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Yeah. And if you watch Tyler Perry movies, you'll know that he has created a universe. And there's something to be said about that. Any artist who can create a universe and sustain it over a long period of time, like, that's just a feat.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that, like, what's his name? That white guy. He's like the white version of Tyler Perry. He makes...
I'm sitting here like, who?
Wes Anderson.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right.
I don't think he's ever gotten that comparison before.
You're welcome, Wes. But he does a similar thing. And obviously we can have arguments about taste, yeah. But at the end of the day, it's interesting to me. And I'm also interested in the audience that Tyler Perry courts, because I think that they are an audience that is kind of considered to be folksy by some people, an audience that doesn't necessarily, they're not going to be the harbingers of what good art is, but obviously, he's making something that means a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah. And they're underserved.
Yes.
Like, you know, there's not traditional media made for them. So, I mean, it's the way you described it, I mean, sounds really familiar. Like, the same thing. Like, I grew up in Memphis, so, like, and most of my family's from Louisiana. So, like, we just started getting DVDs. I feel like they just came in the mail one day.
Like, it's so true.
Literally, they were just there one day, and we were like, all right, we're going to watch some of these plays. And I had never really, like Brittany knows, I'm not super into theater.
No.
But we used to just watch these plays over and over and over again.
What's a Black holiday without everybody gathering around overstuffed to watch a Tyler Perry live DVD?
Yeah. And, you know, and initially I was like, I remember just always feeling like something about this is off. But like in the group, you know, like you just kind of fade into
that's such
like
a good
feeling.
Description.
So like I mean it was the same thing. And then but honestly I think once the movies started coming out, I think that's when I started having like a more of a knee jerk like wait. Something is wrong here.
See, I saw Diary of a Mad Black. I contributed to the opening weekend ticket sales of Diary of a Mad Black Woman.
Support Black art, huh?
And I actually, like, I super enjoyed it. I, like, really, really, really enjoyed seeing it. There's something that was, like, it was really fun. It was easy to get into. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, like, it was breezy. It breezed by. And then also, like, that was kind of during an in-between time where there weren't, like, and we've talked about this before, you and I, Eric, like, about how in the late 80s, early 90s, there was just, like, a whole bunch of, like, movies just about Black people, like, with all Black casts. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, even there were, like, a few television shows. Actually, more than
a healthy amount of television,
shows in the late 80s and early 90s. And not just talking about only Martin or only The Cosby Show. Like, there was, you know, obviously Fresh Prince. There's
A
Different World. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A whole slew of, like, UPN and WB. Girlfriends. Yeah. Right. You know, and then, you know, that kind of trickled out into, the 90s as far as film is concerned. You had, like, Love Jones and you had, like, The Best Man, The Wood, The Brothers. Like, you still had these, was that Two Can Play That Game? Yeah. But, like,
breaking all the rules.
Yeah, breaking all the rules. But, like, by the time it kind of got to be, like, I'd say around the mid-aughts, that well had kind of dried up.
And
if I think back on it, I was probably thirsty to see something like that. Because part of being a Black child is that because there's not a lot of, like, entertainment aimed at Black young people, basically you go from watching, like, whatever children's movie
Gullah Island.
Right. You literally go from Gullah Island to, like, watching a bootleg DVD of, you know, whatever.
Something PG-13 or R-rated.
Exactly. Like, there's no bridge. There's no, like, bridge in entertainment, whereas I feel like a lot of, like, white young people, they have, like, that sort of, like, that tween market kind of figured out.
I mean, the young adult genre is just, like,
it's
what
massive.
That's supposed to do.
Yeah, and like, we don't, I feel like I was like 11 and my mom handed me a copy of The Color Purple, like, you need to read this. I was like, I mean, it's true, but it's also like, 11, how much are you absorbing at the age of, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like, I was thirsty for that. I was like 17, maybe 18, and I was like, I think thirsty for that kind of content with just all Black folks in it.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to scents, you should pick ones that smell like, well, you. Target gets it, which is why they offer a range of personal care products with fragrances for everyone. Be true to floral you with Dove Peony and Rose Body Wash. Live your fresh life with Degree Ultra Clear Deodorant. Express your decadent side with Love Beauty and Planet Coconut Shampoo. This spring, choose care that brings you joy beyond labels. Pick up new favorites at a Target near you or online at Target.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Like, I think everybody would be hard-pressed to admit that they have some affinity for, like, Tyler Perry. Like, I mean, it's that comfort that you find. But in addition, it's like, I mean, he also just has kept folks working. Like, he's kept a lot of people working. And to a degree that, like, I think he often doesn't get as much credit for. Like you said, in that universe.
Kimberly Elise. Yeah. Lynn Whitfield.
Yeah. Cicely Tyson.
Angela Bassett.
Maya Angelou.
Hello.
He definitely deserves to be kind of applauded for that. But I think it's like, I mean, the thing that I often struggle with is kind of like, at what cost?
Yeah.
You know? Like,
there's the question of the day.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about before we got here, you talked about kind of the commodification of Black women.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that the Black woman is kind of at the center of his, like, entertainment ideal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, honestly, that's a theory that I can get behind. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like, that's, I don't see a problem with that. But the way he chooses to, like, express that ideal is, like, it's weird. Like, it's weird in the sense, like, there are a lot of stereotypes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, whether it's, like, the Black woman is trying to save someone else or, like, struggling with her own spirituality.
Yeah.
Or even the more explicit stereotypes, like the fact that he takes to dressing as a Black woman.
Yeah.
You know, in this, like, clear, like, mammy-esque character.
Yeah.
Like, that shit is just, that's the thing that kind of makes me struggle with his content. I would say more than anything. Like, mm-hmm. like honestly, because, like, Tyler Perry movies remind me of, like, they are the Christian equivalent to, like, Niggleture. Like, you know what I mean? Like, true to the game. Like,
You've never heard of Niggleture?
I've heard of Hood Lit.
This Hood Lit, like, but it's
Jesus.
Also Niggleture.
It came from Jesus. We got it from Jesus.
Oh, of course yeah. It came from Jesus.
Yes, Jesus said Niggleture.
And, I mean, it's apt. It's like an apt description.
That's an accurate term. You know?
And, like, I have mad love. I've read True to the Game at least, like, three times. Mm-hmm. Coldest Winter Ever. And, like,
Coldest Winter Ever to me is, like, Pulitzer work. I wish. I don't even.
It's in the canon. Like,
please. Like,
I was obsessed with erotica. I read Zane all the time.
Hello.
My God.
I watched the movie. I watched Zane Addicted, the actual film.
Wow.
Within the past year.
That's actually recent, right?
Yeah.
It's recent.
Yeah.
I'm still in a relationship, too. Isn't that funny? Subjected another person to this, and I'm not single.
I mean, it's crazy.
Put your faith in God. Look what happened.
But yeah, so, like, Tyler Perry kind of created this, like, offshoot of that. That, like, I don't have any problem with. I can support that. Like, I can support you telling these stories that honestly don't frankly get told. But, like, yeah, some of those, like, caricatures and tropes just really, like, are kind of off. Is that where it gets weird for you? Because I find some people, for some people, it's not necessarily even that.
I mean, honestly, that doesn't bother me that much. And I think part of it is because I'm always wary of the argument. Obviously, there are black stereotypes. Mm-hmm. That is can't be contested. However, I think that you can engage black stereotypes or maybe even subvert them in a way that's still artful. Like, I don't think that black stereotypes just shouldn't be in any black art because they're, like, bad or they send a bad message. Mm-hmm. However, my problem with Tyler Perry is that the writing is so bad. It's like you can just see, you know, whatever, like, three or four people were in the writer's room. They were like, all right, it's Monday. We need a script by Wednesday. Work it out. Do what you got to do. Like,
but they're not stressed.
At all, because they're just going to, like...
They go home at 5.
Yeah.
They're going to repopulate the scripts with, you know, the same... light skin, dark skin, like, tension or whatever. Like, thinly veiled Christian saviordom or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's where my problem actually lies. Because I think that, like, the stereotype thing with Tyler Perry can also be applied to Spike Lee. It can be applied to most black male filmmakers. Oh, I wonder what the problem is here.
Please go on.
Could it be men?
Please go on. But seriously, what you say about Spike Lee, say more about that. That's a nugget right there.
I mean, Ira Madison III and I actually talked about this very briefly on our podcast a couple of weeks back. But I think that because Spike Lee went to film school and had a certain pedigree and knew things of aesthetics, his use of stereotypes didn't necessarily hit as immediately when you watch, like, a Tyler Perry movie. Because Tyler Perry is just, like, there's no... art.
There's no dressing.
Yeah, there's no dressing. Like, there's no, like, oh, let me lead you through a story, whatever. Yeah. It's very just, like, blunt. Spike Lee is the opposite of that in style. However, in subject matter, you know, it's the kind of thing where, like, I get a little bit older, I'm a little bit wiser, my side eye has grown, and I'm like, Jungle Fever? Like, why is Wesley Snipes talking like that? Like,
Jungle Fever is...
Why is Halle Berry doing, you know?
It's the craziest movie I've ever seen.
So I think that... And then the other thing is with Spike, I'm going to give you the real. Having been accepted by a white audience, I think really affected the way that he was remembered critically. Because, like, white people don't watch Tyler Perry movies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, that is, I'm going to stand behind that statement. Like, I think it's pretty
I think it's accurate.
Accurate. But Spike Lee courted a white audience. Mm. And they kind of, like, made him this, like, art house, like, black artist or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're not going to know what a black stereotype looks like because they don't even know what a black person looks like. So I think that he was able to actually, like, finagle himself really well in terms of gaining acclaim but still being considered, like, a down black artist in a way that just would never be available to Tyler Perry, which I think is a conversation we need to have. Tyler Perry... He doesn't come from that, like, New York arena.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting, especially if looking at those two specifically, especially for the clear disdain that Spike has for Tyler Perry, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, they're friends now.
Well.
They're cool now?
I feel like ish. They ain't really cool. Yeah. Like Tyler ain't at one of Spike's, like, barbecues. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like, he didn't come
true.
To the Prince block party. Like, it's not going down like that. But, I mean, it's clear that, like, Spike does think, because he has this, like... You know, he has the artifice of, like, I'm an auteur. They're producing a different product.
Yeah.
And that's a great point. It's a lot of tropes in Spike's films, too.
Well, you know? Even what you say about, like, I'm an auteur, it makes me think about what we watched here last Saturday morning.
What was that?
The Kanye West.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Lord.
Video.
Ooh.
We gotta talk about that. That's not just a tangent.
Yeah.
No. That's, like... So what had happened is that I go to bed at night. I go to bed early, so I wasn't about to be sitting up waiting for Kanye West to show me some shit I was going to see on YouTube the next day. I ain't got time for that.
Yeah.
And so my boyfriend works overnight, and he was at work, and he was like, oh, Kanye about to release this video, about to drop the video. And then he watched it that night. I woke up, and he had texted me, like, an article, like, from Complex, kind of, like, explaining it. And I was like, I don't have time to do this right now. Like, I have to get to work. Like, I don't want to go into this. But then we were, like, sitting just doing some administrative stuff. And then I was like, let's watch this video. I was like, I'm tired of writing this fucking email copy or whatever, let's watch a little Kanye.
And yeah, you watched
Famous.
It. And we watched it. And it was like, long story short, on my end, I just felt like this person has such a fucked up relationship with two women.
Yes.
It is not even, women, boundaries,
yeah,
objectification, what he considers to be art, what we consider to be art, and like the fact that he knew that he could give this to a lot of people and a lot of people would somehow find it transcendent.
Yeah.
I was so upset in so many levels. Never mind the fact that the next day I watched 4 of the 5 parts of the OJ 30 for 30 documentary.
Oh my God.
So like having the Kanye like right next to the OJ, I was like, do y'all not see? It was so stressful, but I feel like you say about Tyler Perry, like he doesn't have like that white acclaim because white people don't even know who the fuck he is, right? But like I would argue that a lot of his films do deal with some sort of theme of black female punishment, punishing a black woman for wanting something, whether it's sex outside of her relationship, wanting more money, wanting more professional acumen, and then somehow she gets punished throughout the film, right? Mm-hmm. And people pick up on that and they'll talk about it and it's a thing. And I'm not necessarily condoning that. And some of it I do have a serious problem with, like Temptation, for one, I had a lot of serious problems with, where like the lead character contracts HIV seemingly as a punishment for, you know, stepping out of our marriage. But Spike Lee, and definitely to a very, very, very sharp degree, Kanye West, can kind of get away with shitting on black women in so many different ways. And Kanye's example specifically in Famous, just violence. Like, it's either, like, omission or violence of black women in his imagery.
Yeah.
But, like, because he has some sort of art, there's, like, an art house shroud around it. So it's, like, it makes it okay.
Exactly. I think that's such a shrewd point. And I think you can see the problem beginning actually in the art world. Because the art world is, I mean, I'm not an auteur myself, but I do know people who wheel and deal in that world, and it's extremely segregated and extremely racist. However, there is like this trope that occurs within it where it's like, oh, there's like the one like problem genius black child that they all lift up. Mm. And I think the paragon of that is probably Basquiat in the 80s.
Yeah.
And we can talk about Basquiat's like really difficult like relationships with people like Warhol and Madonna, you know, like he was like really, he was just in a dark place. Yeah. And, you know, he ends up dying in his 20s. And so I think that like white people, there's like an erotic tinge to their obsession with black men in that world.
Mm.
And I think the black men like really just like fucking love that shit. Like Kanye West, he gets off on it. Like that's his fuel for life. You know how like the fact that Taylor Swift, first of all the in the Famous video, all the women, their breasts are exposed.
Literally, except for his wife, which is so fucked up.
And it's her ass is exposed, which is another thing. Because like whose ass is that actually? So Taylor Swift is right next to him. And obviously he's pointing to the controversy that happened where Taylor was like, no, I didn't actually consent for you to say that you fucked me in your song.
Yeah.
Or that you wanted to fuck me in your song.
Yeah.
So she's next to him and she's this like lily white girl or whatever. And I think your point about the omission of black women, black images, is so apt in that little duo. Because when I was watching, I was like, the whole point of him putting himself next to Taylor Swift is to say, like, this white girl, like, didn't even want me, but I can still, like, use her image and I can put her next to, like, my black body. You know, and it's about Kanye West. A grand theme of his music has always been like, in some ways, it does have to do with his weird relationship with his mother, but it's like gaining fame in a way that kind of like means that he has to leave the past behind. And for him, like black women are his past.
Yeah.
You know, there was Alexis, there was Amber, there's his mother.
And Amber is in the video, but like on one hand, Amber does not readily read as like what woman. You think of necessarily
Absolutely.
When you think of a black American woman. But in that way, she almost feels like a stepping stone. Do you know what I'm saying? Like he just found like a whiter version of Amber who is willing to join up with him for the rest of his life.
And even the way he demonizes her, like now that they're not together, you know, it seems like very much a rejection of, you know, his past self. Now, like Taylor Swift specifically and his like refusal to let that go is really interesting too, just because that's usually the thing that gets you up out the paint. The fact that you are claiming some sort of like sexual agency over a white woman is not traditionally well received, you know, by white people at large.
Yeah.
So like, I mean, it does say a lot like that his quote unquote artistic portrayal of his desire for that is what makes that okay. Like, it's clear that the art of it all makes whatever it is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like, it's like, it's honestly, it's just like, it's troubling. Like, it's really, really, really troubling. Like, I don't know. I don't understand. Like, I've stopped trying to understand Kanye.
There's no, Kanye literally in that video put the image of Bill Cosby.
Yeah, like.
So,
right so next upsetting. To the image of Caitlyn Jenner, who was also topless, right? Like, who's also, like, his mother-in-law, right? And it's just like, what is the point of provocatively, quote unquote, invoking Bill Cosby's image whatsoever? I see that as nothing but violent and invasive to anybody, right? To certainly, I would guess, a strong quarter, third of the population, that's going to be stressful just to see this person's image in like a music video. But then also to have this person's body next to not just, you know, not just a white woman's body, but also like a white woman whose body is so politicized. People are always curious about her body. People are always gawking at her body. And like, couldn't make a very personal choice to live how she wanted to live without also inviting the rest of the world into conversation about her body, right? Like, I find nothing transgressive about showing her bare chest. I think that's violent, doubly violent, because this person is in your family, just like with your wife and your ex-girlfriend and somebody who technically is a colleague that you have a very bad relationship with in Taylor Swift. It's just like, I think it's abusive kind of to use these people's like nude bodies for your gain and just to like kind of shock people. And it's like interesting, not just angering, but interesting to me that not everybody sees it that way.
And I actually am surprised at the lack of think pieces. Like, this is the one spot where I'm like,
I think it's because it was boring.
Thank you.
It's over 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
We fast forwarded through the middle 6 minutes.
Yeah, it's just, there's no, it's just like, oh my God, like heavy breathing and snoring, people in somnolence or whatever. Like, it's just, there isn't that much concept behind it. And in fact, the concept that it does have was ripped from the original artist. And so I think that Kanye's, I don't know, his run might be in a bit of a tizzy if he doesn't like, he can't just lean on this like very elementary idea of essentially introducing stress in an audience and then saying that the stress is the evidence of art. Okay. That's what like first years at art school do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm going to shock you. And it's like, you cannot shock anybody anymore.
No.
You're married to a Kardashian. They can't even shock people anymore, which is why they're making apps. They even know that that shit is done.
Yeah.
And so for me, I almost couldn't even feel that the images were violent because I just thought it was so boring. Like, I was just like, there's no introduction of an idea here that you didn't tell us before. We already know that you think this way about fame, and we already know that you think this way about how you should be empowered, I say this in air quotes, as a black man. Kanye, I think the real shift, if we're going to like maybe look at the first half of hip hop to the second half that we're in now, is like, I think that black men who are, like, you can look at Aesop Mob, even Jay-Z to an extent. It's way more about, like, integrating themselves into white spaces of luxury and art and all that stuff. Like, you know, they're rapping about Margiela now. Like, that's not what they were doing 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at. But I do think that Kanye, his specific project, it's just played out to me. It's like, this dude is about to turn 40 years old. He clearly has a lot of anxiety about it. And he's like trying to always place himself as the weather vane of where hip hop is going. And I think that hip hop is not even going in that direction anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you made a couple good points there. Like, so there definitely is that kind of this like clear shift to, it's like, to having hip hop be considered high art. Like you said, like, you see it through ASAP Mob, even like folks like Ian Connor, like who we don't even have to.
I'm good.
Yeah, exactly. But and like Jay-Z too. But the thing that I think is interesting about Kanye is like, he really sees himself, he's kind of perched himself at quote unquote the peak of that, like the top. In addition, he's also much more vindictive than, you know, than anybody else in that mix. Like, he really sees himself as, like having been victimized mm-hmm. before on his ascent. Mm. And so now that he's, like, gotten himself at the top of this, or, like, claimed that space, now he's like, I want to make everybody else pay for, like, making wow. me feel bad.
That's
which is, like...
crazy. It's like, if you start off as a first-year teacher, on your ascent to principal, you will feel like... people were mean to you. That's no. like anything. Like, it's like when I went from $7 to $9 at Books A Million in Washington, D.C. Like, there were people who were mean to me on my ascent to getting a raise. But, like, that's life. It's, like, bizarre yeah. to me that he feels somehow entitled to be, like, just free of that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. He does see himself as, like, he thinks it's clear that now that he's gotten to a certain point, he thinks he should be without struggle. When, like, being black is struggle. Like, that's, like, that is the whole thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And he sees himself as, like, oh, I've done this thing that is great. Now I should be outside of that. I should be able to exist outside of white supremacy, outside of racism, outside of, you know, everything.
And it's funny how Kanye conceptualizes the idea of struggle in his life, because there's one reading that says, oh, Kanye really had to, like, fight to get to where he is now. Mm-hmm. And there's the right reading, which shows a kid grew up middle class in Chicago, mm-hmm. had really extremely intellectual, intelligent parents, mm-hmm. was a successful producer, you know, experienced some pushback within the community of black rappers and black producers who were like, oh, like, you're never going to be a good rapper. Became a great rapper. Married a Kardashian. Like, it's just like, oh, the two, like, big struggles you had in your life are the death of your mother and George Bush. Like, those aren't actually, to me, I don't think that they have enough fuel to propel him into 2016 necessarily.
Yeah.
But maybe not. I think I'll take out the example of his mother's death, because obviously that is.
I mean, that's devastating, but it also is, like, that's a part of, like,
yes.
I mean, that's a part of living. And number two, it's, like, it's a blessing that you do outlive your parents, right?
Yeah.
That's, like, something that I hope to expect to deal with. Like, that's, you know, that's, like, life.
It's life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, his wife went through that. Like,
yeah,
Kim lost her father when she was extremely
very young.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just think that he, in some ways, maybe I'll get a lot of shit for saying this, but his compulsion to always victimize himself, like you say, it's like a weird, like, white male thing.
Yeah.
It's like victimizing himself over the over the wrong things. Yeah. Maybe that's why he's, like, always identifying with Disney and Steve Jobs.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them. Like, I mean, Warhol. Like, he mm-hmm. He wants to be among those names.
Yeah. Yeah, you rarely... Oh, my God. When has Kanye ever said that
himself?
He wants to be, like, a great black creator of art?
Never. I would love to quiz Kanye to see if, like, he knew the names.
Knows somewhere.
You yeah. know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
Wow.
I guess Steve McQueen, in a way, but he sees Steve as more of a collaborator.
Yeah. Yeah. He sees him probably as a contemporary and a peer.
Which is...
Yeah, says a lot in itself.
Very funny.
Oh, man. Ooh, wow.
I just feel like we just hit.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. I'm like
yeah.
sitting
dark.
In that for a minute.
Yeah.
Like. Oh. And so. So this brings up kind of a larger point to, like, all the things that we're kind of talking about. Like, which I think actually does also relate to Tyler Perry. Like, mm-hmm. so with Spike and, you know, let's say, like, a Kanye, there definitely is kind of this... Well, I think Spike at one point wanted to be among, like, wanted to have more vindication from, like, white people and,
yes.
and the white film world. It seems now that he's somewhat retreating from that. Like, now I think as he gets older, he just wants to kind of continue doing his thing
yeah.
and have the ability to do that. And Kanye clearly still and seemingly will never get over his desire to, like, to be accepted by, like, mm-hmm. white people and white people of a certain class and stature. But Tyler Perry, interestingly enough, doesn't seem to have that same desire and is probably more, like, reviled for it. You know, like, he doesn't
yeah.
seemingly have much desire to elevate the way he produces his art, like, to elevate his quality, like, across the board. He's like, look, you know, I kind of got my lane and seems so much more comfortable kind of staying in it and just catering to black folks.
Well, that reminds me of like a quote from this Rembert Brown piece from New York Magazine about Tyler Perry, where, you know, he says that like his audience is the group he still identifies with and feels part of and sees the humanity of in a way that both Hollywood and a sizable chunk of the American public do not understand. It's an audience who doesn't see this as fringe entertainment, an audience who sees this as the best entertainment, the only entertainment. Like,
yep.
Tyler Perry and a lot of his audience thinks that the quality of the storytelling and the production is great. And like on some level, that almost makes me feel like almost like protective in a weird way. Yeah. And of some elements, kind of the same way that I was protective of like when Lemonade came out. I just wanted to be like, you need to have written about this, and this for this many years, and you need to read all these things and seen The Color Purple at least 7 times before you can even put your fingers to a keyboard to say shit about Lemonade. And like, I kind of feel that about some elements of Tyler Perry's work, where it's kind of like, what do you actually know about who this is for?
Mm. I think also Tyler Perry, as much as he is singular within the film industry, certainly has a class of, in general, Black creators that he's a part of. You know, yeah, they're the singers who, like, only sing for us. Like, his class is the BET Awards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. Did you guys watch the BET Awards?
I don't get BET.
Oh, okay.
I have the shittiest case. I only get public access.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Well, it doesn't matter if you didn't watch it. But I think you can get my sense of saying everybody in that audience, most of the people, were people that only Black people knew.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. Maxwell was there. Like, you don't see white girls going up for Maxwell.
Yeah.
And it felt like, it felt really safe. And I understand what you're saying when you say protective. And so I think Tyler Perry, he does actually have a contingent of people that he can relate to as creators. And the number one being Oprah. Mm. Oprah and Tyler Perry in the past few years have essentially created this like indomitable, both like capitalist, like teaming up, but also artistically.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. you know, he has a bunch of shows on OWN and they're always like collaborating or whatever. And so, I don't know. Tyler Perry gives me a lot of anxiety about myself personally, somebody who went through like a lot of white schools and obviously was taught to critique in a white way.
Mm. Yeah.
I feel like, oh shit, like have I been that deeply gentrified that, you know, I can like stick up my nose?
That we're too good for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that we're too good for it. Like, what does that mean? And what does it mean where like you feel too good for it and the white people in your space like understand that?
Mm.
It's like, I don't need y'all.
Yeah.
Y'all don't need to have an opinion about the Black people who love Tyler Perry.
Mm.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same way. Like, one of the things we were talking about is like, there was a time, this was when I was at Howard,
mm-hmm.
where I was like, my mom would be like, oh, we just got the new Tyler Perry DVD. I would be like, Mom, don't watch that. Don't, like, it's not that good. Like it's like he's a mammy. Like, blah, blah, blah. And, like, Mom's like, okay. And literally, like, went on about her business. And now, like, honestly, I'm to the point where, like, they love it, and I get it. And, like, some of it is really good. Like, I actually went and was watching some clips for the haves and the have-nots.
Yes.
And that shit is actually kind of good. Like, like, I was sitting there like, oh, damn, like, where can I find this? Like, I was mad that it's not on, like, Hulu or Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I'm just saying, like, I get it now. I think you have to kind of release, like, a lot of the, like, pretentiousness. Like you said, that release a little bit of the lens that was given to us by someone who does not look like us.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, and now, like, now I think I have a bit more appreciation for it. I do still want to talk to him about some of the stuff that he puts in his films, though. But, you know, at the end of the day, he got more money than I do.
Yes. So much more. A lot more money than I do.
Yeah, he's one of the richest men in Hollywood.
And
he's barely in Hollywood.
No.
He owns a studio.
Culturally.
They shot...
It's like a town, right? In Atlanta?
Yeah, it's like a little mini village thing. They filmed the first Diary of a Mad Black Woman. They filmed, like, the mansion that the mm-hmm. main characters live in was, like, that's his house. And that's the house that he bought off of Stage Plays.
Yeah.
He
Got yeah, like, that's the thing. He was huge before he was making movies.
Yeah.
And the fact that he still does those stage plays says a lot, too. Again, going back to, like, catering to that, like, specific type of audience. The fact that he's now he's not too good for that, you know, I think really, really, like, says a lot.
Yeah, my parents just went to see a Tyler Perry live show a few weeks ago at the Detroit Music Hall, maybe a couple months ago. And they had a hell of a time. They had a great time. They say put on a fantastic show. Which, I mean, we've all seen in DVDs, we know.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And he is a good actor. I think white people are probably introduced to that via Gone Girl.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. The little coon can act.
He was in Gone Girl? I never saw that movie because it was about...
You don't need to see it.
Yeah. It's like literally about a whole bunch of shit that like I just couldn't care less of. The main reason I don't go to the movies, honestly, well, once I had a traumatic experience in the movies where people thought a bomb was going off. So, like, I haven't seen... Yeah, it happened in the middle of like Iron Man 2. So I actually haven't seen a single superhero movie in like 4 years. But outside of that, most movies are about white people falling in love. And like, don't get me wrong, Nancy Myers puts out a movie about anything. If she put out a movie about shoes or fish or books, I would fucking watch the shit out of that shit. She put Anne Hathaway in it. She could bring Meg Ryan and her raggedy face back. I do not give a fuck. I will watch any motherfucking romantic comedy bullshit that she puts out because I love her.
Nancy
I love
all Myers that shit. Hive.
Yes, I'm in the Nancy Myers hype. But most movies to me are about like white people climbing rocks. I never saw that movie. 127 hours? You know why? Because why the fuck would I be by myself in a crag in the middle of the fucking desert? That rock fell on his arm. That's not relatable to me. And that's how I feel about a lot of movies. I'm like, I can't be moved to go see them.
The black version of that movie would be 1 minute long.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to go to the crag? Nope. Yeah. That's it.
Let's play spades.
Yeah. Roll credits.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but the thing is, though, is that, like, it's really easy. Like, it's, like, on the weekend and stuff like that. Yeah, my boyfriend, we don't have cable. Neither one of us has cable. Like, we find ourselves watching a lot of, whether it's Tyler Perry or, you know, something in a similar vein.
Yeah.
Because I'm never not interested. I'm never not interested in that because it's about me.
Yeah. And I think the familiarity, it's just, it's really comforting. And that's why I described it as a sordid comfort, because I still absolutely am enraged by the way that he portrays black women in particular. And also, I think that, like, he needs to step the art quality up, the production quality up. But still, it's just like, there's like a base level, I don't know, it's like my pleasure neurons just start spiking when I see like all black people on a screen. And that's the uncanniness of stereotypes. Yeah, they're evil, but they also sound like us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Every, like, mother in a black Tyler Perry movie is a caricature, but also sounds exactly like your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head there.
You hit the nail on the head.
And I think, I mean, honestly, I think probably to wrap it up a little bit, but I think I had more of an issue with Tyler Perry when I felt like Tyler Perry was kind of, like, the only one out there, like, making film. At like a certain frequency and level.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, like, now, I mean, now that you have like Ava DuVernay, you have like Ryan Coogler, there are a lot more, well, not a lot more, there are a few, a couple, a couple more people getting shout outs, you know. Like, I think there's slowly becoming like a little bit more diversity in terms of like how much black film, how much output. There is. Like, there's becoming a range, which when he first started making film, I don't think there was as much.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and I think there was a fear that this is all we're going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he is becoming so famous and gaining so much of an audience that it's like, oh, man, if he fills the entire void, then we're just going to be watching Diary of a Black Woman forever.
Thing. That's like the scarcity myth though about like all black art, which is that like they're gonna like this one person is gonna fill the hole that like that we're confined to, but like we're not confined to a hole. At the end of the day, black folks, we're so thirsty to see ourselves, we will find more money in our pockets to spend on each other.
Yeah,
that's true.
Isn't that beautiful?
It is.
It's like a capitalist love story.
So I think that's a good note to.
We love capitalism.
Yes. Yeah. Fish better have my money.
So, Doreen, thank you so much.
You're fantastic.
Thank you for having me. This was amazing.
So, you're amazing. Yeah. This is great.
I had so much fun.
No, you're awesome. I'm so excited to keep listening to the podcast, keep reading your writing.
Yes.
Thank you.
And you have to come back again.
Yes.
Yes.
So thank y'all for rocking with us. Mm-hmm. If you want to support the show, you can leave a review on mm-hmm. iTunes. We always appreciate it. Five stars only.
Five star chick.
In addition, now you can support us on Patreon.
Patreon.com/forcolornerds
and just throw us a couple scraps. We appreciate it. But other than that, we will be back soon.
Soon. Can't say when always.
Yeah.
These days.
Don't
but
quite
that's
know.
Why if you support us on Patreon, this shit will come out more regularly. Yes. So back at y'all.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.